Podcasting from Nashville, Tennessee, this is Keep Asking, the weekly podcast that helps you dive in a bit deeper and wider into the research providing insight into today's church and culture. I'm here today with my colleagues Scott McConnell and Casey Oliver to talk about some things we learned in our mental illness study that we did, the one sponsored by Focus on the Family and a private donor. And welcome back, guys. You ready to have some fun today?
Yep, ready to jump in.
All right. So, Scott, I believe you have our opening question.
All right. Here's the question for today. When you're on a road trip and you're not the one driving, what do you like to do to pass the time?
So this is pretty rare, actually. I'm normally one of those people who I'll drive for 10 straight hours or whatever. So a lot.
So
of
your wife never gets the chance. Don't even give her the option.
She doesn't like driving as much either. But so if I'm in this situation, I know I can't read. I get car sick if I'm trying to read in a car. So I think a lot of times this conversation, you know, it's a good time to sort of be able to have a longer conversation than maybe you do in the midst of a regular day. So
for me, audiobooks, that's especially, even when I'm driving, that can be a great chance to just knock out a big chunk of time, you know, while you're driving. But because I'm so navigationally savvy, I don't need to be paying extra attention. That's kind of a joke. But audiobooks, I have noticed lately on short drives, though, I've been opting more to hop in the back seat so I can play. It's the time I give myself to cheat and play like a game on my phone. And then so it's like, oh, I've got a little bit of time. Let them chat up there at the front, that kind of thing.
Yeah,
so
you didn't specify that there was more than one other person in the car. You sort of were like, oh, I just hop in the back seat.
I did say that if you're not the driver.
Right. Okay.
But there's somebody else in the other front
right,
seat.
Right, yes. Yeah. If it's more than two people, I won't hop in the back seat just to make someone show for me and they can't see that I'm playing Fairway Solitaire on my phone. So how about you?
Mine's changed a lot through my life. As a kid, I read a lot. And of course, that was a long time ago before there were like easy video players in a cars like kids have it so easy today. Mm-hmm. But sometimes, depending on where you're driving, you know, I actually would watch the scenery because there, you know, it was kind of fun to just see different parts of the country and where people lived and those kind of things.
Especially if you are in a different, where the landscape is really different, that can be.
But now, to me, the ideal, I can't listen to music that doesn't keep me awake. I mean, I will for a stretch, but not very long. So I need something where people are talking, as Casey said. So I'll look for things on the radio that are like the best is like a baseball game or a football game where something's happening and I have to follow it because that keeps me awake.
But then it's on some AM station and you start losing it 10 minutes.
Yes, like, yes.
How long can I put up with the amount of static that's going on?
So satellite radio in a rental car is fantastic, but we don't have that in our car. But yes, an audiobook can do that as well, or picking up a talk show or NPR or somebody that's talking. And so something you can follow and that kind of keeps me awake and going. Or if the kids are listening to a video in the back and the audio is through the whole car, then even listening to, there's several videos that I've never seen the movie. I've just heard it.
Oh, that's fantastic. I remember the first time, and this is back in the 70s, when we didn't have videos or video players. But we got radio headsets. My brother and I got radio headsets. I mean, literally had an antenna poking up out of the headphone earpiece. And we would actually come to Nashville almost every summer, go to Opryland, that kind of thing. And we rode, and I remember telling my mom, it was just so great. We each had control of our own radio. And I almost felt guilty telling my mom how much fun and how much better that made the drive. And she said, oh, we thought so, too. So, that kind of hurt. But it can be, you know, kind of good. All right. So, Scott, we're going to be talking about the interviews we did with some of the experts on this mental illness project. Can you set the stage a little for the goal of this project?
Yeah, this was a large project where we were trying to understand how the church is assisting those with mental illness and even how it could be doing that better. And that's to be helping them, especially on some spiritual dimensions. You know, how well can the church be assisting somebody spiritually and helping them in their discipleship? And you know, there are definitely several elements of this project that were to understand better what is actually possible, and as well as what is currently taking place. And so it involves quantitative surveys with people with several severe mental illnesses, schizophrenia, bipolar, and severe depression, but also family members of them, and as well as pastors. But we started with qualitative, as we often do, because the things we could learn from those qualitative in-depth interviews, in this case with experts, could influence the questions that we ask on those quantitative surveys. And so the interviews were with mental health experts.
They were some of the best interviews. Oh, wait, that's not going to sound right. Some of the best interviews I've ever done. But as far as actually enjoying them, these were really brilliant thinkers, but also practitioners, people actively engaged in helping those dealing with mental illness, but also writing on it, doing research, and creating resources for pastors and churches. So it was really interesting. One, probably a big thing that the, one thing that came up as I talked to these experts is that there are some programs or plans that a church can incorporate into what they're doing, but how a church and how a pastor jumps in to, hey, we're going to lead our congregation to be thinking about this, can really vary. And it a lot of times it depends on that a trigger moment, whether or not it happens at all, according to the experts, was it, how the pastor themselves is impacted. So typically they see a connection when the pastor deals with one of the illnesses and they've encountered it, a family or friend of the pastor, a church staff member, or one of their immediate members, or I don't want to say key member, but a key leader, someone that the pastor is pretty connected with in the church. So it's a proximity. It's one of those things that even though the pastor may counsel people or address it, when it becomes something the pastor leads the church to understand and work towards as a whole body, it's typically because there's been a pretty significant personal encounter.
And so I guess to build off of that, you're talking about the specific ways that pastors might be better prepared and or you know able you know I guess to help with that. But what are some of those actual ways that pastors can help people that are in their church facing mental illness?
Part of it is just actually being prepared and recognizing, okay, if you're in one of those situations where it's having an impact, seeking out resources, understanding what's going on, but starting out with compassion as people are dealing with this, there can be a lot of shame and stigma for the individual and also for the family members. When there's severe mental illness, the experts talked about the heavy, heavy weight that family members carry. And it can vary among, you know, the different illnesses, but there's embarrassment, especially with bipolar, that, you know, a lot of times it doesn't get diagnosed until there's very dangerous behaviors going on. And people have done things either to damage the family, damage the other relationships. And so compassion often isn't a natural response because there's a crisis. So if a pastor and leader can be a voice of compassion as they're looking to help the family walk through it, help the church understand, that can be really good. And give the people in your church an opportunity to have honest conversations about what's going on. Now, that doesn't mean blurt it out, obviously, but the experts talked about these have such real and cost. Well, there's just a real impact on families and a need for honest, you know, families to be honest about the challenges they or the individual are going through, and the people in the church to be honest as they handle it. But increase awareness, study, learn about the prevalence of mental illness, what it is and what it isn't, what is helpful and what is harmful, and how to connect and support. A big tool is knowing what you can't help with, and understanding, you know, when you're talking to someone and understanding some of the signs that, this is something we should recommend. And wherever you are, what are the closest resources, professional resources, spiritual, emotional, you know, physical health, how have those lined up so you know how to direct folks to get to the resources that are available? Because a lot of times if the family or the individual is going through crisis, they don't know exactly, they don't even know how to pursue the help.
Casey, from the quantitative research, we asked people if somebody experiencing a serious mental illness, whether they can thrive spiritually. What do people think about that? And we'd love to hear what the experts thought about that.
Yeah, it seemed like in really all three groups that we asked, the family members of someone in their household with acute mental illness, and someone with acute mental illness themselves, like Scott said, either schizophrenia, moderate severe depression, or a bipolar disorder, and Protestant pastors. For all three of those groups, about three quarters agreed to some extent that someone experiencing a mental health issue can thrive spiritually even if the illness has not been stabilized. Now, the strongly agree percentage for that was 29% for those going through it, and up to 35% for pastors and 38% for family members. But so three quarters are at least somewhat agreeing or higher. So yeah, I'm interested in hearing kind of the differences, or if there are differences between that and what a expert might say.
There is quite a contrast in what the experts talked about. And I think there's some hope in these numbers, but also some challenges. And what I got from the experts is some real caution. So one of the things I hear in the numbers that Casey just shared is that people can find comfort. I'm hearing that they can find comfort and hope and elements of their spiritual life going on. I mean, they connected with the word thrive, but the mental illness experts cautioned that it is really hard to make progress and to do things that require energy, focus, attention, all of those things, if you're in an unstable crisis mode. And they really advocated getting that patient to a stable place and addressing it. Now, all of these were believers, people who practice in a Protestant evangelical faith tradition. So all of them incorporate elements of faith into what they're saying, and would even have that be a part of it. But they would also remind people that in that unstable state, there's a lot of things happening, physical, emotional, psychological, all of that. So I think the same way it's hard to thrive spiritually if you're in financial crisis, you know, making a leap, or if you're in a health crisis, you can take comfort and you can still be a believer. There are ways to be faithful. So it's not, none of these are an excuse, but also realize that there are factors impacting you and you've lost some control. So I think a big picture of what they would advocate people to understand is keep expectations really low for the the individual with the illness and also those in their family, and really push towards getting them the help and the resources to getting to stable, because their whole life is going to do better when they get to stability and learn to, and because at that point they have to learn to live stable again.
So you've talked about kind of in several different areas of their lives what some of the challenges that people with acute mental illness could be going through, but how about specific to discipleship? Are there things that that we see that are specific challenges?
Well, there's inconsistency. You know, if you're dealing with, you know, specifically we focused on the things that are occurring with bipolar, depression, schizophrenia, then those basic activities that you would see as spiritual disciplines, you know, you're going to be inconsistent. If, you know, as if you're off spending thousands of dollars, you know, it's hard. It's unlikely that you're also charitably giving, or it could be charitable giving that's actually over the top, actually unhealthy, spending the family's resources, you know, so it's very complex and inconsistent. It's difficult for folks who are in that unstable, unmanaged, it's difficult for them to get incorporated into groups because they can often be bringing so much of that into the group dynamic. And if the group isn't prepared for that, they can have trouble making relational connections, especially and with depression, maybe they're just not getting out of the house as much. With bipolar, they may have had damaged relationships, so there's a loss of trust. Schizophrenia, there can sometimes be a flat affect or a difficult reading. You know, others may not feel that connection to that person, and they may not be as quick to sense a connection to God or sense, you know, when God is moving in ways that are more normal. And I don't want to say normal, typical for others going through that. And another thing is, and I think this cycles back, their actions can be having a negative impact on the groups that are around them. So discipleship, as we've studied, it's not solo. You're going through with others. And so circles back then to inconsistency.
From our quantitative research, we know that family members very much would like pastors and churches to be talking about mental illness to kind of remove some of the taboo. If leaders begin to do that, those who have experienced mental illness, how could they begin to actually to bring up the fact that this is something they're facing?
Okay. Well, I think one of the ideas I got, I can't remember which expert brought it up, but they talked about practicing your story before you share it. And so getting to a place where you can be honest, accepting, even kind to yourself, and then being careful about where you share it. So it's not fair for every group to expect everybody with mental illness to completely conform to that group, and it's not fair for everyone with a mental illness to think every group is going to be a good match for where they're going to go. So they want to be looking and trying to understand where a safe group may be. And that may or may not be a structured group that's going on inside the church. Now, hopefully, even if there's not a small group that's already together within the formal discipleship structure, maybe there's a family or a group of families that can create that group. And ideally, that would be a mature family, people with some margin in their lives that they can add, you know, provide a protective place. But you want to look to people who are going to be safe. Communicate to someone before you share what you hope will happen and what your expected benefits and challenges are, so that you can get some feedback from someone you've already told, you know, as you've helped learn your diagnosis, and make sure those are realistic and they're fair expectations on the people in that group as you share. Practice, decide how much to share. And then again, begin with the leader ahead of time. the more realistic you are and being prepared for a variety of reactions can be very helpful. And so I think it's it's being very gracious on both ends, which can be challenging. And I think one of the things that they mentioned is a lot of times as the person and the family are going through this, they're going through their own phases of grief and their own challenges. But it's also a big spiritual element is realizing their own need for grace, their own need for God, for their need to depend on God through the challenges, how they adapt, how they move through this.
And in the church community, you know, those conversations can only be helpful because we're all facing something. We all have weaknesses in areas, and the more we're honest about those and are talking about those as a community, I think the healthier the community is.
A really good quote from David Paulison that talk about people when they have a severe mental illness, it throws a curveball at our expectations. He talks about that in the church we often have in your local church there's an expected standard of sanctification, a way of behaving, what's normative, what's the normative Christian life. And so when people have this severe mental illness and challenges, they're not going to necessarily match those expectations. I'm not sure if it was David or someone else that talked about when we're thinking about discipleship and where people are going spiritually, we need to make sure we're not pretending everyone's starting at the same place and having to get to the same place. A lot of times, you know, what may not look like there's much progress, you know, if someone is dealing with depression, bipolar, what may look like a very small distance to someone on the outside could have actually been quite laborious and an amazing act of grace and a real fight to just get to where they are. So I think Christians, the Christian body as a whole, experts just need more, want us to have more understanding, more compassion, so that we can give them some room to be dealing with this.
Yeah, that's a great reminder for the church, but also ministries that are ministering to people. That reminder that everybody's discipleship path is not the same, and that we're intersecting with people at different places at different times, and we've got to be ready for that variety.
I know it's time that we've got to wrap up. I think Todd Hall, one of the experts we talked to, he had his advice is good for all of us, but for discipleship, for those dealing with mental illness, one, very basic progress is good. And two, progress will look different in some ways when compared to others. And so I think a good reminder for all of us, if we're making progress, that's good, but also having some compassion. Thanks everyone for listening. Tweet us your questions and feedback to @SMCon, @StatsGuyCasey, @LizetteBeard, and @LifewayResearch. Take a moment and review us on iTunes. Give us some feedback, positive feedback. I always like to ask for. And then tune in next time for Keep Asking.